So, Mark, the seventh chapter, we're going to begin with the story of the Syrophoenician woman. I debated putting a map on here, but in the interest of time, I do want us to kind of get a picture in our mind of what we're doing here. Where has Jesus been most of the time in the book of Mark? What area? I promise I will ask no trick questions in this class. You have my commitment. Galilee. He's been in the region of Galilee. And what we're going to see him doing here is going outside of that region of Galilee up to Tyre and Sidon in that area, and then coming back to that region. One of the reasons that I think he does that, the scriptures bring out, is just because of the continued popularity that he has. Well, as he goes through into Tyre and Sidon, he meets this Syrophoenician woman. The woman's daughter had an unclean spirit, and we are going to read just a few verses here, beginning in verse 24. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre. And when he had entered a house, he wanted no one to know of it. Yet he could not escape notice. But after hearing of him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of the Syrophoenician race, and she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he was saying to her, "Let the children be satisfied first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered and said to him, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the table feed on the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "Because of this answer, go your way. The demon has gone out of your daughter." I want to ask you a question. First of all, what was the basics of her request? Again, promise no trick questions. Cast out the demon. Hadn't Jesus been doing this previously? He was in Galilee, and what had he done a lot of? Casting out demons, right? He'd been doing other miracles too, but they're specifically mentioned in Mark that these demons were being cast out by he and the apostles. He goes to a different region. Evidently, they have heard of him too. She has a demon. What was her request? Cast the demon out of my daughter. Does anybody find that to be an unusual or maybe a stretch of a request for the Savior? He's done it in Galilee. He's in Tyre now. What was his response? Give me a summary of his response. Maybe even a one-word summary. Okay, he was talking to a Gentile, but what was his response to the Gentile? Okay, what else? Was it yes or no? At first, and if you look in Matthew's account, you see that a little more obvious. He said no. The children are going to be satisfied first. That's pretty heartless, don't you think? Okay, maybe there's a trick question. That's pretty heartless, don't you think? Is it? Or what was his purpose? What was Jesus' purpose? This is one of those accounts that, to me, really does describe miracles and their relationship to the teaching of the gospel. We talk about the purpose of miracles, but I really feel like sometimes we put so much emphasis on the miracle that we forget that the power is in the word, not in the miracle. Jesus did not come to earth to heal people. What did he come to do? Not physically heal people. What did he come to do? Seek and save the lost. And so everything he's going to do is going to be focused on that. Now, on the occasion where Jesus wants to emphasize his power, emphasize the power of the Word of God, what does he do? A miracle. But I really feel like whenever we look at even today and the way people look at miracles, They look at miracles as the form of benevolence that Jesus and maybe even by extension some believe the church, even though I don't think we could do miracles today, that's the benevolence of it. The benevolence of our work today is no different than the benevolence of Jesus' work then. It's to teach lost souls the gospel. And I think that's why he focuses on what he does. He's saying, I'm trying to teach the people who should know first. So, with having said that then, what or why was this woman different? Because he does recant, and he does it. Somebody turn, if you will, and read Matthew 15:28 for me. Because I think Matthew does a better job of telling why Jesus changes his mind. It's not emphasized quite as much in Mark. Just whoever gets there. Great is your faith. That's the reason he changes his mind, is because the woman exhibits the type of faith, and I'm going to use a little bit of editorializing here, that he wants to see out of his people, right? That he wants to see out of the Jews. Does he see that faith out of the Jews? Not as a whole. He does not. I don't want to overgeneralize and say that the Jews were not receptive, but generalizing it, they weren't. And he certainly doesn't say this kind of faith. That's one reason why I think he changes his mind, is because she exhibits the kind of faith he's looking for. He wants that kind of reception from his own people, and he finds it out of a Syrophoenician woman. Thoughts or comments? Yes. Yeah, we're unfortunately going to spend a little bit of time maybe beating up the apostles a little bit this morning. But as we do that, I would caution us to put ourselves into their place. I doubt we would act much differently. Okay.
Jesus, who knows the hearts of all men, he knows his disciples' own struggles. He's traveling into clearly Gentile areas. Why are we here? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
And so when he says this, you know, all right, what am I going to give what belongs to God's children to the dogs? That's what the disciples are probably thinking. Why are we here? Why are we spending time with these people?
Yep.
And then to let them see.
No, I think that is a very good point. It very well could be, and I will add some, if I can, some credibility to that comment. Later on in chapter 8, we're going to see he does exactly that. He is also building up his apostles, which we don't need to forget. It's not going to be too long. They're not going to have him anymore. They need to have the kind of strength and the kind of compassion, but I think they also need to understand what is their mission. Is their mission benevolence and healing, or is their mission the gospel of Christ? Because remember, Simon wants this gift. What's the difference between Simon and the apostles? The motivation. His mission. Does Simon want it to teach? Not evident by the scripture. So I think some of it could also be, I think it's a good point, a material lesson for them as well. Any other thoughts and comments before we leave? Somebody back here? Oh, yes, sir.
Do you think that the Lord actually came to heal the sick, or maybe some of them did actually come to heal the sick or not?
I believe that his mission was not to heal the sick. His mission was to save the world. Through that, he used the gift or the power of healing to support who he was and his claim to be the Messiah. But to say that he came as a mission to heal people, I don't believe that scriptures bear that out. Okay. Any other questions? Good question, though. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that most of the Israelites did not hear or obey or understand Jesus. There was always a remnant from the very beginning.
And that remnant was defined as those who were obedient and did what they say. So I agree wholeheartedly. I think some people take that remnant to be inclusive of those who do not obey and do obey. And I think that even the passage there bears that out. But yes, we can't lose the fact that Jesus did come at first and foremost to try to bring the people back. Some of them chose not to. I would argue those were not a part of the remnant that were saved. So very good point. Any others? All right, let's move on to the next section. Talking here through the deaf man. So he leaves Tyre and Sidon and he comes back to the region of Galilee. And I thought this was interesting. I passed over it a time or two at the beginning, but several of these passages brings about the crowd brought to him, fill in the blanks. At first I thought maybe this was just because they knew it, they cared about their friend or their relative, and they wanted them healed. But who was also in these crowds in addition to just the Jews? There were also called out in these passages some other groups of people. There were Pharisees, there were scribes. I'm going to throw out, possibility, right? The possibility that some of this was also a testing of Jesus. Maybe some of the element of that crowd said, this is my friend, I want them to be well. But maybe there was also a part of that crowd that wanted him tested, that wanted to see what he would do, that wanted to see what he would react. And it would fit so well as we continue in 7 and on to 8, because the Pharisees are going to ask him questions. What did they do, the Pharisees, earlier in the book, on the Sabbath day, on at least two occasions? Okay. So I guess what I'm proposing to you is this testing is continuing. Maybe some are legitimate that we want our friend or relative healed, but I would argue that the leaders are continuing to test Jesus through these events. And they're going to use it in chapter 8 specifically to ask him some questions. And he's going to use it as another teaching moment. Let's go ahead and read just a little bit farther down. Let's see, verse 32, and they brought to him, and I guess my point is, who is the they? And they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they entreated him to lay his hand upon them. And he took him aside from the multitude by himself and put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva, and looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, and I'm not going to try that one, be opened. And his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. And he gave them orders not to tell anyone, but the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. So, one of the reasons why I say what I do about the testing, why did Jesus take him aside? Why did he take him aside? If there were legitimate people there, why did he take him aside? Could be a sign of compassion. Kenny?
I don't think Jesus needed to say these things. I mean, obviously, he will do things remotely with other people. It's to show that the power is coming from him, not from somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Any other reasons? Could it be that, and this goes, I think, maybe to your compassion, that he wasn't going to use the man as a pawn or allow the man to be used as a pawn? The fact of the matter is the man was healed and people knew about it. But the spectacle that the people wanted to see, they weren't going to see. They weren't being compassionate with him. And I would add to that, whenever you look at it, why did he sigh? I know that's a minor thing, but Mark specifically mentions the sigh. Turn there, just flip over to 8 and chapter 8, verse 12. And we're going to start in 11. And the Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, "Why does this generation seek for a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation." Could it possibly be the exact same reason he sighed in chapter 7 as the same reason he sighed in chapter 8? We've got a very similar crowd. We've got a very similar request. I'm proposing to you that this is, in chapter 8, is a continuation. Jesus is beginning to be, I don't know if it's frustrated, I don't know what it is, but enough that Mark mentions within just a few verses the sigh that he has. Maybe it's a sigh of sadness. I don't know what it is. But I can tell you something's there because Jesus expresses himself this way. Thoughts or comments or questions or disagreements? Disappointment very well could be the emotion here. I don't disagree with that. Certainly we see that from him towards his apostles in just a few verses. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir. Look, I'll get you. Agree. Isn't that what he says about the 5,000? They came because of the loaves and fishes, or after the 5,000. They're coming because of that, not because of the true power that's in the word that saves, but because they want to see a sideshow. I truly believe, based on this context, that's the reason why he pulls the man aside to do it privately. It's because he's not going to be a sideshow. Okay. But he continues this exasperation, disappointment, whatever this sigh may be, because whenever he looks at it, they're still not getting the point. They are bringing him sick people, right? What should they be bringing him? Spiritually sick people, not physically sick people. He can heal the physically sick people. He can heal the spiritually sick people too.
There's another undertone here in this text, because he alludes, the passage alludes to things that even Isaiah said in Isaiah the 32nd chapter. Deafness, especially in the Old Testament, was also a sign of spiritual rebellion. Isaiah talks about that, I believe, in Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 50. So there's again a messianic tint to this for us today as we read this, but there's that frustration too. This is the one where Isaiah, the 32nd chapter, it talks about the mute will speak, the deaf will hear. It's the exiles will now be restored.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. Yeah. It may be an indication for him, too, about they're all been in rebellion to me.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a spiritual undertone
for
Isaiah, perhaps.
I think that's a very good point. I can heal the physically deaf, but it's the spiritually deaf that I really want to be taken care of, and nobody's listening. In fact, isn't really what he's asking is for their spiritual ears to be opened. He opens the physical ears, and I think that's a very, very good point. Any other thoughts before we move on? Oh, Kenny?
These weren't the signs that were given.
No.
The thing about it is with I would imagine if I was growing up a Jew, I would think, when I think of miracle, I would probably think about the plagues of Egypt. These were undeniable signs that we were overcoming Egypt, and we were getting out of there, and we were no longer going to be under bondage, and we were going to be under God's rule. And where's the plagues? And they weren't looking for healing. They were looking for destruction.
Whenever, if you read the Old Testament, that's exactly what would come with the Messiah, are these types of things. Yep, no, I think it's a good point. All right, moving on. We talked a little bit about that. Mark chapter 8, the feeding of the 4,000. So the first thing, and I know this is maybe painfully obvious to some, but there are two occasions. Jesus feeds two different groups of people on two different occasions. 5,000 that he fed earlier, the 4,000 that he is feeding now. So let's read just a little bit of this. We'll begin in verse 1. In those days again, when there was a great multitude, and they had nothing to eat, he called to his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the multitude, because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their home, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a distance. We're going to stop there. Is this the same or different than the first occasion? The same or different? That is a true statement. That's where we're going with it. Yes, sir.
In the initial case, I think he was trying to retain them to teach. Here he said, well, if you don't do something, they may not survive at all.
Okay. And that really, and we're going to jump on that because that to me is the meat of it, but this is one thing that's a little different. In the first instance, he's keeping them so that they don't go back. I think the people, not the leaders, the people have morphed. Now he said, they've been with me for 3 days. Maybe he sees that the people are staying for some right reasons too. Did they stay 3 days? Did he heal for 3 days? My guess is that he had them there for 3 days teaching them and them listening to him and them learning for them. And not that Jesus didn't have compassion on the first set, but I think it was the response from the people that changed the occasion. And Jesus is going to use this as an example to his apostles to teach them a lesson. But let's continue on. And the disciples answered, where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in this desolate place? Oh boy. Does anybody find that strange? Why in the world would these men, after they had taken the time to line the 5,000 out, into 50s and 100s, the time to take those few loaves and few fishes and to collect back all of the baskets that they did, ask such a stupid question? And I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it the way it is. A stupid question. Do you think their memories were that short?
No, they were blind.
Sir? I certainly think that's a part of it. I don't want to be too critical of them. Here's the beaten up part, right? I don't want to be too critical of them. But if just a few days or weeks or months, whatever it was, I don't know that I have a good feel for the amount of time that has transpired. I just saw somebody take 5 loaves and 2 fish and feed 5,000 people and collect back 12 baskets. Somebody got 5 loaves and 2 fish. We can probably do it with less. But if you just at least give me 5 loaves and 2 fish, 4,000 people are taken care of, right? If we do the math, we may be able to do it with like 4 and 1. But they don't. It's like they are so blinded by something, I don't know what it is, that they can't see who is in front of them. And Jesus is really going to hammer them on it. Because really, in one sense, they are no different than the Pharisees, not being able to see it. And I think he really brings that point up. Yes, sir. Here's what I do with this, and this is just me. Each one of you are going to have to figure out what to do with this yourself. I use this as a trigger whenever my faith causes me to question something. I'll give you an example. I did this really bad thing. Can God really forgive me for something so horrible? Is baptism really what God has intended for salvation? Insert your subject there. Don't let our limitations be the limitation that we place upon God. I think that's what these apostles were doing. Physically, it is impossible to feed that many people with so little. And yet, as they're sitting in a boat and he calms the sea, as an unclean spirit is removed from an individual, I'm looking at that going, there's not something normal about this. Maybe I ought to set aside my preconceived ideas, my thoughts, and just trust what this man is saying. Their response should have been, I'm going to give you my opinion, and this is an opinion. Their response should have been, hey, can we do the same thing with the 4,000 that we did with the 5? We'll go find a few things. We don't have to go do this. We've got the power to do these things.
Somebody who looks perfectly healthy is suddenly no longer with us. I think the part of the miracle here is the will of God, that God is willing to. It's not that he couldn't, but that he's willing to do something here, and that's a difficult thing for us to predict.
That's a good point.
To me, there's a lesson for us. Faith building is a journey. There are things in our lifetime that we always have to have the constant reminders. And just piggybacking on the point that Kenny is making, it takes these men 3 years, and even at the end, that some of them don't still understand. We see the scenes after the resurrection with Thomas and Peter and some of the others. But if I look at my life, there are things in my life just like why didn't I see that?
Yep.
Why didn't I put my faith in God? And it's a journey and a maturation process. And passages throughout the New Testament are riff with those warnings to us. Be mature. Strengthen your faith. Grow your faith. Trust in God that he will and can do these things. Even when we're in space and circumstances where we don't see it right there.
Yep.
Jesus is trying to get them to see the big picture. They don't get the big picture. He'll go into that later on as you're going into chapter 8. They don't see the big picture. We don't see the big picture a lot.
Yeah. And again, I prefaced it at the beginning of the class. This is not a beat-up session on the apostles, but we need to take lessons from them to learn. what had they been given authority and power to do in chapter 7 and the mission to do in chapter 7? The 12 were sent out to do these very things. We've got to take what God gives us in that maturing process and not shrink back. It's almost as if they're still not learning the lesson. They're not taking the things that they see with their own eyes. This isn't to your point, somebody saying, hey, did you know he fed 5,000 people? I saw him feed 5,000 people. I collected it. I handed it out. I brought it back. We cannot lose those learning opportunities. We can't. We have got to take the learning opportunities that we have and not shrink back in our faith. Because I think this is a classic example of them not getting it enough that their faith shrinks back. Go back and read what they did in chapter 7. They had power. They themselves knew. Don't let the lesson be to us to continue in our faith maturing, but don't shrink back. Any other thoughts as we move ahead? Yes, sir. That is certainly an option. And it would explain some things. I don't think, for me though, I don't think it explains why he's frustrated in verse 12. That would be the only thing that to me would... But that is certainly something that we should consider. Maybe this, for those of you who didn't hear, is a different group of disciples. And maybe they haven't seen it.
Well, I'll verse 12. Mm-hmm.
No, it's a very good point to bring up. I think if it is that way, then there is an additional lessons that we can learn from that as well. So I think it's a very good point. That is a perfect segue. You're pushing me into the next point, right? So the Pharisees test Jesus. See, I've got Micah over here and Josh over here that are pushing me to keep going. No, I'm just kidding. The Pharisees then, and if that is indeed the group, this is where we come and we begin to see their part of it there in verse 11. And the Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign. We read this a little bit earlier. And 13, he said, and leaving them, he again embarked and went to the other side. And they had forgotten to take bread and did not have more than one loaf in the boat. And he was giving orders to them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. Now let's stop there a minute. If this is the same group, it's the third instance. If it's a different group, it's the second instance. Are we still so concerned with not having it? Do we not see what has happened and what has transpired? They're continuing to worry about this bread. Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets full of broken pieces you picked up? They said to him, 12. And when I broke the seven for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? And they said, seven. And he was saying to them, do you not yet understand? So I certainly concede that those differences. I will say this, there is still, regardless, this level of frustration that even his closest 12 do not get it. It's almost as if he wants to throw up his hands and say, stop worrying about the bread. I'm going to provide for you. I have the power to do this. You've seen the power yourself. You've witnessed it. You've laid hands on it. And you continue to worry about it. I see frustration here. I don't know if anybody else does, but I read that in Michael's tones. But that's my belief in where he's going with this. He is frustrated. He is absolutely appalled that they can't see what is right in front of them. The blindness that you mentioned. They can't see it. And why is it, do you think, that they can't see it? Why? They're looking for the wrong thing. You know, if I look for one thing because I have a preconceived idea of what that is, I'm going to miss all of the facts that point me to something very different. And I think that's what they're doing here. And again, this is the fourth time I'm going to mention it. I'm not in a beat-up session for the apostles because, brethren, I will speak for myself. I'd probably be in the boat worrying about the bread with them. I would. They have been trained from a very young age, and Kenny's brought up this point a number of times, to look for something much different in the Messiah. So they're not looking that direction. And when the obvious stares them in the face, regardless of all the passages of Scripture that you could read to the contrary, when all of that, you're not looking that direction. This is what happened. So again, my goal is, what lesson do I take from this? When I read a passage of Scripture and it says, thou shalt or thou shalt not, I better lay aside my preconceived ideas about what I think that passage says, and I better listen to what the Bible actually says about it.
I think one of the things, he starts off by this by saying, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which he repeats over and over again, and beware of the leaven of the Herodians. That's both opposite spectrums. That's the people who are ultra-religious and the people who are not ultra-religious.
Yep.
And basically he's saying they both got it wrong.
Yeah. Yep. Thoughts or comments?
Mm-hmm. You know, most of us, me myself, sometimes I pray for things and I want it as soon as possible, or I think soon as possible, right now. But, you know, I know that I have to wait on the Lord because in all his time will he provide that what I've, you know, requested.
Yeah. Lord, grant me patience, but hurry. Yeah. I've said those at times myself. I think whenever we look at this, We have to take the lessons that God gives us, and we have to take the most of those lessons and make the most of them. Don't underapply, don't overapply. We have to apply them appropriately to what is said. Yes, sir.
In John 20, verses 30-31,
mm-hmm.
Paraphrasing, it says, there's lots of signs, not in this book, but their purpose was for you to believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. There's a possibility here that, and certainly, I think it's clear, that miracles are not necessary. So the disciples may be thinking, is this good enough situation to help validate Christ
right.
as who he says he is?
That's true. So we don't want to overuse the miracle. We don't want to underuse the miracle. We're trying to figure out where that could very well be. Maybe this is that maturation process that Eric mentioned. That's possible. All right. Thank you for the discussion. We will begin there on Wednesday night. And just for the record, I made it a whole chapter. It was just across two. How's that?